Welcome to Film on Radio. Who's counting Marilyn Waring on sex, lies, and global economics? This is the second part of an hour-long program based on the Canadian film by Terry Nash. Marilyn Waring is a feminist economist and the author of If Women Counted, published in some countries as Counting for Nothing. Her humor and intelligence makes her one of the respected founders of the alternative economics movement. The film now takes us to the Middle East, where the Dubai Air Show is in session.
I think everybody has been staggered by the enormous success of the event this year, with comfortably over 400 companies exhibiting from all over the world, widespread of aircraft of every class. The Dubai show is now incontestably
running in third place behind Paris and Farnborough.
And pulling, Steve Martin, pulling hard into a very tight radius, 360 degree turn. Pulling 9G at least, demonstrating the aircraft's complete capability of maneuvering at very high G and very high thrust.
The great importance of this in any combat aircraft is that it frees the pilot's entire attention.
Looking out of the window and at what he's supposed to be doing, which is attacking the enemy.
The international trade in arms is the biggest growth industry of all.
Scout aircraft are acquiring targets at day or night.
The five permanent members of the Security Council are also the five leading arms exporters in the world.
Out beyond 10 kilometers, mass mounted sight.
Killing people, or preparing to kill them, is considered very valuable in the international economic system. Arms exports account for more than half the trade surplus of the developed economies. But the death, homelessness, injury, poverty and starvation caused by the use of these weapons is not even registered as a deficit.
If a country develops an economic system that is based on how to pay for the war, and if the amounts of fixed capital investment that are apparent are tied up in armaments, and if that country is a major exporter of arms and its industrial fabric is dependent on them, then it would be in that country's interests to ensure that it always had a market. It is not an exaggeration to say that it is clearly in the interests of the world's leading arms exporters to make sure that there is always a war going on somewhere.
Every minute, 30 children die from want of food and inexpensive vaccines. And every minute, the world's military budget absorbs $1.3 million of the public treasury. This is war. For every 100,000 people in the world, there are 556 soldiers, but only 85 doctors. This is war. For every soldier, the average world military expenditure is $22,000. For every school-aged child, the average public education expenditure is $380. This is war. The cost of a single new nuclear submarine equals the annual education budget of 23 developing countries with 160 million school-aged children. This is war. War is marketable. War pays, literally. War contributes to growth and development. Philippines can be seen as a microcosm of the entire developing world. These are the hills overlooking the port city of Cebu in the southern part of the Philippines. It's a rural area which has been left vacant by an absentee landowner. A group of families have moved onto this land and built their huts and established a community here. Most of the men only get sporadic jobs, or they provide cheap labour for some of the large cash crop plantations around the country. So it's really up to the women themselves to provide for the children. The average Filipino woman has 8 children to raise and no access to abortion, family planning, or divorce. You can imagine the anxiety that a mother of 8 must feel if she doesn't know where she's going to get enough food to feed them all every day. This is the reason that women in rural areas all over the world grow food crops or raise farm animals. This sort of farming is usually called subsistence agriculture. It doesn't involve the exchange of money, but it does ensure that these children will eat. The system of national accounts says that the domestic and personal services which don't count are the cleaning, decoration, and maintenance of the dwelling occupied by the household, the cleaning, servicing, and repair of household goods, the care of the sick, infirm, or old people, the transportation of members of the household or their goods, the preparation and serving of meals, the care, training and instruction of children. The World Bank would argue that to change the conditions of life for these people requires export growth, to make room for productive exporting enterprises. These unproductive women and their families would simply be kicked off the land. The new company could then take further advantage of the homelessness it had helped to create by getting cheap labour here. The number of homeless children in the urban squalor of developing countries is now epidemic in its proportions. The cycle of poverty begins to repeat itself very early, as the eldest girl in a family at age 8 or 9 is expected to give up school and look after her youngest siblings, while her mother uses that time to do whatever she can to keep her family alive. Older boys may be left to fend for themselves and to sleep in the streets. Jennifer and Renren are 10-year-olds. They're just 2 of the children available through this Japanese brochure, which sells men-only tourist junkets to the Philippines. Recent studies in Thailand, which also has a lucrative business in female sexual slavery, have shown that 70% of the women and girls have become infected with the HIV virus. Those who sexually exploit children are counted as doing productive work, increasing economic growth. Even if their activities are illegal, they're considered valuable enough to be in the calculations because they're income generating. Female sexual slavery is a major growth industry worldwide. And where a multi-million dollar industry in prostitution is operating, full advantage is taken of this grinding poverty. Foreign-owned companies and a small Filipino elite own 90% of the land. In a country of 58 million people, 20 million are now homeless. Thanks to multinational monocrop plantations, the Philippines is the 14th largest exporter of food in the world. And yet 80% of the children who live here can't get enough to eat. Over 1 billion people on the planet are malnourished. In the developing countries, 50,000 people a day die from malnutrition. $17 million children in the world die each year from diseases that are related to poverty. Two-thirds of these deaths are preventable. The gross domestic product claims to measure the well-being of a country. When my friends Imelda and Loris harvest New Zealand seafood for their families, it isn't seen as economically valuable. But if they went and bought the oysters in tins at the supermarket, then that would be counted.
Before the Europeans come on, the Maoris never ever had electricity and things like that. So their food mainly depended on from the sea, was gathered from the sea. We have a custom that's called Kai Moana. Its meaning is gathering of food, mainly shellfish, from the sea. We go out when it's the tide's low and pick up seafood, mussels, oysters. The oysters take about 2 to 3 years to grow, so that's why you just take a little bit.
Yeah, we only usually take enough food for a meal, you know.
Then if you're still hungry in a couple of days, you come back and get another bucket full, and then you have them fresh all the time.
But we never sell it. The old Maoris don't sell shell food. It's not meant to be. It's meant, you know, they...
Give it away, you never ever sell it. You get the odd one who'll take it back to the cities to sell, but the elders usually come down hard on them and say, it's costing you nothing, and if you come and take a whole lot of food from here, then the next person that comes along to get some can't find it because you're taking it all away and selling it for money. You should leave it for food.
Well, if I'm going down to a beach to collect Kai Moana, I always behave the way that I've been taught by the local people, by the Maori people. And I find in this and in so many of the practices in Aotearoa, in New Zealand, that they make perfect sense. I mean, both perfect economic sense, perfect environmental sense, perfect ecological sense, from, you know, centuries of tradition of indigenous people. So why change it? Why behave any other way? I certainly feel in this entire journey that my constituents and then women and the ecosystem has been my teachers. Very early when I was a member of parliament, there was an application made for a prospecting license on Mount Porongia by a company called Gold Mines New Zealand. And the planning procedure was such that the mining company could show all the apparent good that was going to accrue to all of this area. We'll provide loads of jobs, we'll provide loads of support to the service infrastructures, you know, your schools will stay open, you'll get more roading, your post offices, all of those kinds of services, your electricians and plumbers and everybody else will have loads of jobs while we're involved in all of this. There'll be export earnings, it's gold we're talking about. There'll be substantial reductions in overseas funds. You know, we'll be here for years. The usual growth development kinds of arguments. No debit side, you notice. There's never any debit side in terms of this kind of development. Nobody talking about what you're going to do with all the materials that you take out of the mountain that then begin to leach into surrounding farmland. The kind of
scarring that would be happening in the bush and the forest and the mountains, the ruin of the habitat of so many species. Colin Murray was a party official in my constituency and a key member of the local farmers' organisation working against the gold mine licence.
It's a fascinating mountain because it's different every day. A little bit of cloud behind it. It was a volcano originally. It also plays a big part in our lives because it affects the weather so much. We have 90-inch rainfall here, which makes this area so good for dairying and farming generally. And that's brought about to a very, very large extent by Mount Porongia. The water around here, I have a lovely stream through the farm across the road there, and the water, the tests that the Waikato Regional Authority have done on the water, it's amongst the purest water in the country, and that's just something you can't put a value on.
Economics is a tool of people in power. I mean, economics didn't just come up from nowhere. It's a tool of those who want to exploit. It's a justification. And so as a so-called science, it doesn't allow for the introduction of values that don't find their way into a mathematical formula. It also operates in terms of language. You know, if you want to argue that mining this mountain would be devastating, you are invited to use a whole lot of words that are called soft, you know, flaky, value-laden, subjective. Economics has got it down really tight, you know, so that if you're not talking their language, if you're not talking in their jargon, you're not part of the argument, you know. So the power of economics mirrors to a great extent, you know, the political power rampant anywhere else. You operate with language as well as operating with mathematics. The economic activity that the mountain is engaged in is like 24 hours a day, never ending. It's the habitat for the pollinating species, without which none of this agriculture could survive. It's controlling the microclimate for the production that comes from everything out here. It's breathing. I mean, it's creating oxygen. And it provides hundreds of hours for just what is euphemistically called leisure and recreation, tramping. None of those features can find a very easy expression in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, you can't run around and say, oh, well, so much oxygen is being produced from these trees on a 24-hour basis, and the same volume of oxygen in containers in a hospital would equal, and therefore the 24-hour oxygen production of this mountain equals. I mean, who's going to do that? This entire story so early in my political years demonstrated to me the absolute hollowness of the mathematical formula that we have to work with. I met with Federated Farmers, the environmentalists, the rural local authorities, the city councillors, and we sat and discussed this mountain and what it meant to us.
And we were invited to somehow or other number crunch all of those values into an economic equation and to set ourselves up against Gold Mines New Zealand Limited.
There was a tremendous uproar from the locals and plenty of meetings, well attended, and with Marilyn Waring's help we managed to block the miners, so that's not going to take place now. It's a forest reserve now. It's all that bush-clad mountain is reserved as a forest park. This here, this farming that you can see all around you, is here forever. It's not going to go away, and we're producing something far more valuable than gold. We're producing food and clothing for people, wool and so on. And, you know, mankind can do without gold, but you can't last long without food. You know, that was our argument, and I think it's the argument. This goes on forever if we look after it. It's ours for a short time while we're here on Earth, but someone else has then got to take over. And providing we look after it, it should get better and better.
It was just a local story, you know, in my constituency. But I think as an analogy, it can be expanded to the whole planet.
But what are we after then? What are the alternatives? Your country, Canada, or mine, New Zealand, where there are political will, could establish qualitative environmental indicators. Indicators that told us what was happening to water quality, air quality, the remaining stands of forest, the exploitation of mineral resources, the reproduction of fish species, the habitats of endangered species. There is no reason why tomorrow Canada or New Zealand could not establish time use surveys, because the one common denominator that all of us have, the one thing we might be said to choose to exchange, that is our own, is time. And time is a better description of the needs for intervention in people's lives than any other indicator. It shows you where the crisis points are. It shows you where the service needs are as a policymaker. In a study conducted by the Commission on the Status of Women in Canada, it was demonstrated that 2/3 of all primary health care took place in the home. If 2/3 of the budget for primary health care were directed towards those responsible for that care, imagine what would happen to that budget and how that budget would be redistributed and how the priorities would be turned on their head. These are the kinds of effects in a budgetary sense that would flow from time use surveys. Why don't policymakers or politicians or bureaucrats like this idea? Well, first of all, it's terrifying. They would have to exercise judgment. They don't have a unidimensional set of figures to which they can look and say, is growth up or down? Thereby hangs our decision. Language is a tool available to all of us. None of you, when you leave this room, should ever again say, my mother doesn't work, my wife doesn't work. That particularly relates to people who are in media or teaching positions. Take your census form. It says, what is your primary occupation? Well, be inventive. Pick up the business pages of Saturday's paper. Be a logistics analyst. Be a management supervisor. Be anything that fits, you know, the kinds of things that you do. Just don't be a housewife. Don't be a home engineer. Don't be anything that uses the word house or home in it. You know, how many hours a week do you work? 96, 107, whatever it is. How many weeks a year do you work? 52. For whom do you work? Well, that's an exciting one. What's the name of your company? I've found that women can be extremely inventive here. It's good fun, mucking up the census. We've got that rolling in quite a few countries. Push for parity. Join political parties and go to their annual conferences and year after year after year, drive them crazy. Half the candidates shall be women. Half the candidates shall be women. Join this party till you get it through, then move on to the next one. I mean... Just as there is no one-way feminism, there is no one political tactic available here, there is no one political strategy. It is broad and as wide as our imaginations can take it once we have heard and seen and recognised that the emperor has no clothes. You must choose, judge, assess the strategy and tactic in your environment, in those communities that I don't have access to. Just as I do it in communities you won't have access to. I mean, the only principles are that we don't stop, that we are rigorous, that we recognise that it's hard work, and lastly and not least, that we have a lot of fun along the way.
You heard the conclusion of an hour-long radio version of the 1996 film Who's Counting? About the New Zealand author and former Member of Parliament, Marilyn Waring. The film was directed by the Oscar-winning Canadian director Terry Nash. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. For a copy of the film, call the U.S. distributor Bullfrog Films in Olli, Pennsylvania, at 1-800-543-3764. That's 543-3764. You can find more information on Marilyn Waring on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's TUC Radio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this radio program by calling us. TUC Radio is listener supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.